Well, the 1980s pop duo Wham sold over 30 million records. They were one of the most successful and influential groups of that decade. They conquered the US and they became the first Western band to tour China after the Communist Revolution. At the heart of the group were friends George Michael and Andrew Ridgeley, who met at school when they were like 12 years old. Careless Whisper was written by both George and Andrew when they were just 17 years old. George initially came up with the saxophone riff, that iconic saxophone riff, when he was riding at the back of a bus. It reached number one in 17 different countries. How did these teenagers who were like scribbling songs on a bus become an absolute pop culture global phenomena? Well, that is the story of the 2023 Netflix documentary simply called Wham. Stay tuned to hear more about George and Andrew's musical journey and what it has to teach us about friendship. Welcome to Pink Door Culture Club, your eclectic entertainment guide with a sprinkling of amateur philosophy and theology. My name is Jeremiah Burns. This week on the show, we're looking at the Wham documentary from 2023. It's a really fun, really moving and insightful look at something that you kind of might assume is pretty superficial and silly. Pink Door Culture Club is a YouTube show and podcast. It's released every Thursday, Australia time. And you'll also find some little pop culture proverbs published as YouTube shorts on every Tuesday. If you like the show, please subscribe and share and comment and like, and feel free to reach out and be in touch with me as well. It would be great to hear from you. Now, the first segment of Pink Door Culture Club is called Spellbound, where we think about what makes the Wham documentary compelling viewing. And the first thing, like I kind of just alluded to, is that it's a really fun and touching story. It's fun for lots of reasons, but I reckon it's fun because of Andrew's personality. Like, this is evident in Andrew's childhood videos where you can just see he is up to no good. It's evident in the opening video at their high school where they're kind of just teasing everyone. It's evident in all the press coverage that they do where, again, Andrew doesn't really take anything that seriously. And it's evident in all their musical videos as well. Andrew was absolutely hated by George's family. And you can see why, because they were, you know, pretty strict and kind of had pretty conservative views of what you should do with your time. And Andrew was a real kind of contrast to that. Another thing that's fun in there is Andrew's sense of style. George basically let him direct the fashion of the group. And that's where you get all of that color and all of that flair, all of that neon, I guess, from the 1980s. Another thing that's fun is the music and identity of the band. You know, this is a band that's a reaction to punk music, you know, which is like really intensely trying to be political and protest everything. And it's a group that refused to be like that. It refused to be too serious or political. They kicked off with the Wham rap, which kind of talked a little bit about unemployment and commented on, you know, are you happy in your job? And so there was kind of that appetite for these guys to be, you know, political commentators, but they didn't want to be that. And when they did kind of go down that path initially and record Bad Boys, like George says in the documentary, like he absolutely detests that song because that's not who the group was trying to be. Whereas Club Tropicana, Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go, these are kind of the songs that embody, you know, who they were and make it really fun to watch. But it's also a really touching story because of how long-standing and deep the friendship is at the center of this whole thing. As I mentioned at the start, they literally met when they were like 12 years old. And that happened because Andrew agreed to look after George on his first day as the new kid at a new school. And we'll talk more about what this whole documentary has to teach us about friendship a little bit later on. So it's really fun. It's really touching. A second thing that's great about the documentary is the contemporary media. I mean, this is the 1980s. it's the video age. But similar to the Beckham documentary, which you should definitely go back and watch my commentary about, where in that case, David Beckham's father was recording all of his soccer games. In this case, it's Andrew's mum, Andrew Ridgeley's mum. She's keeping scrapbooks of almost every single day or week in the life of the band. She has like 50 scrapbooks, which they kind of capture press clippings, and she writes comments in there. So if you're a parent out there and you're keeping a scrapbook or a video record, keep at it. You know, in this case, it really helps to structure and signpost the documentary. Even though there's kind of tangents off to different themes, which they kind of come back to in a really nice way, the scrapbooks kind of help kind of unpack the chronology of the band, I guess. You know, another thing that's there in terms of contemporary media is amateur recordings. So we get to hear a really, like an extremely early audio recording of Careless Whisper. And you can hear that, you can hear George has an incredible voice already. Like it's pretty scratchy. His voice is not fully developed. He's not quite confident yet, but it's really cool to hear. You see Wham on video recording at some pretty dingy nightclubs. I think they describe themselves in the documentary as D-list celebrities. But there's also like video of them as friends and on breaks when they're in Ibiza or France or backstage. And again, being the video age means there's a lot to work with there. There's also a lot of TV recordings. So their Top of the Pops performance, which is lots of fun, even though they're a bit embarrassed about it. All of their music videos, their concert recordings, the Live Aid recordings, and all of the press interviews. So there's plenty there for the filmmakers to work with the unique thing and the strongest thing probably being those scrapbooks that I mentioned from Andrew's mum. A third thing and a final thing to mention about this that makes it so strong is the narration. I mean, this story is told through all of that imagery and contemporary footage that I talked about, but it's really just narrated by George and Andrew. George is, you know, speaking from the grave through archival recordings, whereas I think Andrew made some new recordings for the purpose of this documentary. And they both have like pretty clear memories about what happened. They have a pretty balanced sense of the past. They have a good sense of honesty and humor. Like, you know, George is pretty upfront. He talks about how he wanted Last Christmas to be a number one song, and it was going to be their fourth number one in the UK for that year. But, you know, he got called in to do the charity song, Do They Know It's Christmas? And, you know, that was going to help, like, starving kids, and that was great, and he was part of it as well. But really, he was just actually pretty disappointed that Last Christmas didn't make it to number one, because that song got there instead. So, you know, there's something good that he could reflect and be so honest and open, you know, as part of the interviews that they wove into this. There are times when they're a little embarrassed by things when they look back, but I think mostly they're accepting and they're pretty at ease with themselves at that stage when they're recording their narration. Particularly, they're a little embarrassed, I think, about their Top of the Pops costumes and the dancing. I reckon it's kind of, the 80s have gone full circle, right? Like Stranger Things is celebrating the 80s. So I don't think there's anything there to be embarrassed about, but clearly they do feel a little bit of that. It is interesting that sometimes they are at odds with each other, but mostly they're in sync. So mostly they're in absolutely furious agreement about what happened, why it happened, how they felt about it. But there is a little bit of tension there about like moments where George stepped forward, he took creative control, he became the center of attention, and how easy it was for Andrew to step back. Like they both agree it was the right thing to happen, and it was inevitable, and it needed to happen, and it was healthy and all of that. But you do feel a little bit of the pain in Andrew's commentary that Even despite all of that, it was difficult because he had started this group with his friend and there came a moment where he needed to let go. And for him, that was a much greater cost than what George faced. The second segment of Pink Door Culture Club is called Rear Window, and the idea is to look more closely and think more deeply about some of the themes or ideas arising from Wham. The first thing, and definitely the main thing to talk about here, I've mentioned it all the way through, is the power of friendship. The power of friendship. It really is the most touching and the most prominent theme of the whole documentary. I would frame it like this, and they talk about it in these terms. Like, George Michael would probably have become an accountant if it weren't for Andrew. Like, he needed Andrew's reckless, silly sense of fun and creativity to break out and take risks. Like, he would not have done it without Andrew. And Andrew probably wouldn't have made music beyond the neighborhood, right? If it wasn't for George. He needed George's, like, songwriting and lyrical genius, you know, and he needed that to shine through in order to make it globally and become the success that he did. And George was willing to accept Andrew's lead early on, and Andrew was willing to step back into George's shadow and relinquish creative control as things developed. The documentary, I think, provides some great insights into what friendship is. A friendship is not an acquaintance. It's not a colleague. Here is the Wham recipe for a great friendship. Number one, you have a common passion or interest. In the case of these guys, they loved their pop music. They loved their Elton John. So that was the thing that drew them together. You're different. Number two, you're different, but in complementary ways, and you accept that, you celebrate that. So you've kind of got the reckless, assured nature of Andrew with the really earnest, insecure nature of George. You support, number three, you support each other as companions during the good times and the bad times. You know, it was tough for them to get started. They got exploited commercially. Like, they signed a really terrible, awful contract early on, but they stuck with each other and they persevered together. And then fourthly, as we've kind of touched on, you let each other's talents shine and you celebrate the success of the other person, even if that means stepping back at some points and yielding the limelight. Like, Andrew is literally a backing singer at Live Aid, while George is, like, standing next to the piano with Elton John, singing to this amazing audience. And as I said before, it's not without any pain, but he is willing to take that step. He is willing to do that rather than be bitter and resentful or have the group be torn apart by that. These guys had this friendship from school, and I reckon school and university, that can be such a great place to develop friendship, because it's such a shared, intense experience. Like, you're with these people all the time. But I think friendship as an adult is trickier. There's less time, there's less energy, there's lots of movement often, right, between, like, within a city or between cities or between countries even. And you often encounter with adults, like, existing groups, people who have had that childhood or that school experience, and you weren't part of it, but they were, so they've already got a group. And, you know, there's a whole Seinfeld episode about a guy who wants to join their group, and they kind of say, we don't really want another member of our group. Like, how do we tell this guy to go away? We don't need anyone else in the group. It's kind of like the nastiest version of it. But, you know, it's a thing, right? You can have groups where it's difficult to find your way in because it's already established and built on something pretty intense. Here's five quick tips from me about friendship that I've learnt. Some of these I've mentioned in previous episodes. I reckon number one is recognize the difference between social skills and friendship. Like, you need social skills to be a friend, but it's not enough. For a long time, I thought that if you were good at conversation and you had social skills, that's what it meant to be a friend. It meant just being friendly. But it's not that. That's not enough. Because you need to actually, you know, like I said before, it's not just an acquaintance. Like what I was often doing in my life is just building lots of acquaintances, but they weren't really friends. There wasn't any depth to those relationships. Number two, I think you need to experiment with being friends with lots of different people. Like it's not going to work out with everyone. Like there's going to be some people who you meet where you're like, yeah, we'll definitely be great friends. And then it like just doesn't gel. They don't want to be friends, or you realize it just doesn't work. And that's okay. Like that's okay. And I think it's good to like keep trying out being friends with different people. Number three, you got to find stuff to do together. Some people just like sitting and talking. I like sitting and talking. Evidently, I'm doing this show where I just sit and talk. But not everyone does. And it's good to have some things that you can do, some hobbies and other things that break things up and give you something to talk about, like a shared experience that you can have together. Number four, persevere, but don't force it. Like it does take time, so you've kind of got to break through some of that awkwardness. You got to persevere. But like I said about experimenting, you know, there might be a time where you're like, okay, I can't force this any further. I don't want to force this any further. Like friendship's not meant to be like that. And then number five, like don't be like that Seinfeld group. Like have open borders when it comes to your own friendship group as well. It's true that you can only be friends to so many people. I think that's true. But you don't want to be so militant about it that you can't or you wouldn't admit someone else ever. You know, you want to maintain those open borders. A second major theme from this documentary is the power of insecurity. The film makes it clear that Andrew is like super self-assured. He's at ease. He's confident in his own skin. But George is the opposite. He's insecure. He's unsure. He's anxious. He's conflicted. And some of that is like stemming from parental acceptance. Like his dad is pretty cold, pretty harsh, like not really accepting of who he is and what he wants to do. Some of that seems to be about the immigrant identity, the need for professional stability. Like you need to get good grades and get a good job. That's what we are here to do. Some of that seems to be about peer acceptance as well. Like George really hates not being taken seriously and wants to be kind of loved and accepted by his peer group. And some of that, like, really obviously, and it comes through in the documentary as a major theme, is because of the double life that he's leading because of his sexuality and what that was like at that time. In some ways, George's insecurity absolutely tears him up and makes him dysfunctional. But on another level, it's an engine that drives him. It fuels his ambition. Like he needs to demonstrate to his father, to his friends, to his professional peers and to the whole world. You know, it's like he's saying, I am talented. I am enough. I should be accepted. I should be recognized. And I've talked on this show before about some other examples of celebrities who have achieved great things and they're kind of propelled by grief and propelled by dysfunction. I can think of several people who I have known or I have known of who are closer to me who have also seemed like extremely driven to succeed. And there's a lot of bravado and confidence on the surface, but when you get to know them and you dig a little deeper, there is that deep sense of inner conflict and insecurity underneath, which is sometimes driving that. At one level, I reckon that inner pain is a great source of, undoubtedly, it's a great source of creativity. It can lead some people, like George Michael, to create great works of art, which kind of express that conflicted state. And I think we can all relate to that conflicted state to some extent. And or it can just make them super productive, right? Even if they're not particularly creative, it can make you super productive because you want to achieve lots of things. But I think at another level, it is quite dangerous as well. It can be completely exhausting because no achievement is ever enough. Like George is craving, you know, the four number ones, you know, and the famine in Africa is getting in the way. which he can, you know, as I said, like he can laugh about that, but it was really getting him down and really exhausting him. And I think it can lead to quite unloving decisions for others because it's not about you using your gifts and your talents to serve others. It's about this quest to be personally accepted, personally recognized. And like, if you're managing other people, you're leading other people, that can have a pretty detrimental effect on those other people. A third thing to say from the Wham documentary, we've talked about the power of friendship, the power of insecurity, and thirdly, the power of vision. Even though George is struggling with insecurity from a very early age, in a strange way, he's also very clear. He's got a very clear creative vision from the beginning. He knows that Wham is about fun, not heavy politics. That's, like I said, why he hates Bad Boys. Even when they tour China, he knows this is about sharing the values of Wham, you know, of fun and celebration, which is probably, like he says, that's probably why they were allowed to come to China, because they weren't going to be pushing anything heavy or political. He gets Careless Whisper recorded in New Orleans by this super famous American producer, but then he comes back, he listens to it, he shares it with Andrew, and he's like, I don't like this. This saxophone's all wrong. I don't like this recording at all. And he just goes, right, I'm just going to produce this myself. And they say that he went through 10 different saxophonists to find exactly the right one. So he's very clear about what he's after and how he wants it to sound. There's a few times where he writes a song and immediately he says to Andrew, that is a number one hit. No doubt that is a number one hit. So I think it's so powerful to develop and maintain an original artistic vision and let others come to you without any compromise. You know, there's something very pure about that, something very attractive about that. You have to know that your instincts are right. So you can just say, like, I'm going to refuse to change it. It will work out, even if it doesn't seem to be working out right now. And that's quite a contrast to a model that might say something like, okay, let's change or adapt this creative work or this product or this service to suit the audience, to suit the market. Now, I think there's something interesting there. There is a tension there. Like, you hear about the success stories of those who have refused to change, but you don't tend to hear about the artists, the businesses who said, I know I have a hit song, I know I have a hit movie, I know I have a $1 billion business, but they're actually wrong. and it didn't work out. And maybe they should have been a little more flexible. Like, you don't tend to hear about that. So I guess the question that it poses is, like, to what extent do you maintain your artistic integrity and original vision? And to what extent do you eventually change and adapt to meet your audience? The final segment of Pink Door Culture Club is called The Man Who Knew Too Much, where I just list off some other interesting trivia about whatever it is that we're looking at. And this time, a few quick facts about Last Christmas, one of their hit songs. Last Christmas had the distinction of being the highest selling UK single of all time to not reach number one, But on January 1st, 2021, 36 years after its original release, Last Christmas finally got there. And on December 30th, 2022, it reached the top of the charts in the UK again. It's sad, isn't it, that George Michael didn't get to see that. 2 years in a row it got there. It's still, it has kicked on and got its a life of its own. Number two, George Michael was actually sued for plagiarism over Last Christmas. He was sued in the mid-1980s on behalf of the writers of a song called Can't Smile Without You, which I read described as a schmaltzy love song recorded by the Carpenters and Barry Manilow, among others. But I feel like schmaltzy is a denigrating kind of term, and I refuse to have anything bad said about Karen Carpenter. Like, she's got to be one of the greatest singers ever. Anyway, the lawsuit was dismissed after a musicologist presented 60, more than 60 songs that had similar chord progressions and melodies to prove, hey, there's no particular copying of Can't Smile Without You going on here. Number three, lots of people love hearing Last Christmas every year, but there is an internet game called Whamageddon instead of Armageddon, and it encourages players to avoid the song from December 1st to December 24. You can go to the website, I'll put it in the show notes, and there's some pretty simple rules. Basically, once you hear the original Wham version of Last Christmas, you're out. You then have to go on social media and admit defeat using the hashtag Whamageddon, and you have to wait for your friends to suffer the same fate. Okay, so we're at the end of this episode of Pink Door Culture Club. Overall, I really loved the Wham documentary. I have recommended it to a few people who, when they have watched it, have absolutely loved it as well. Even if they knew nothing about Wham, they don't care about Wham, they do see it as a bit silly and superficial, they have loved learning more, and it's just such a beautiful story. It did send me into a listening frenzy for a few weeks at Club Tropicana. I had kind of gotten into their music before, you know, once or twice, but the documentary really is very fun, very moving, and I think the central friendship here is just so great. It resulted in all of that amazing music, but it just has a lot to teach about friendship in general, I reckon. So go out there and, you know, make friends and tend to your existing friendships, is my encouragement this week. As I mentioned at the top, remember that you can engage with the show as a YouTube show or as a podcast released Thursday Australian time and via Pop Culture Proverbs released every Tuesday on YouTube Shorts. However you're engaging, remember you can like and follow and share and comment and all of those great things. And you can feel free to just reach out to me directly through the YouTube comments, the Facebook page, or at pinkdoorcultureclub@gmail.com. Thanks for watching. Thanks for listening.